Does Canada's membership in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization contract the range of the nation's foreign policies? Could Canada lose whatever influence it has by giving up a seat at NATO's table? Does NATO protect us from an aggressive war, or is it a guarantor of more war? How does NATO appear from the perspective of colonized people in Africa, South America, and the so-called United States? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we mark the 75th anniversary of the formation of NATO into a huge global military organization by looking at it from a variety of lenses beyond praising the North Atlantic cavalry. In our first half hour, Eve Engler joins us to break down Canada's connection to NATO and how peace activists may consider life without NATO. In our second half hour, journalist Rick Rozoff, who specializes in opposition to NATO, spells out what is objectionable about the organization in the larger picture. And right after, Ajamu Baraka of Black Alliance for Peace tells the tale of what is objectionable about NATO from a black radical perspective. On this week's program, NATO at 75, a diamond anniversary of security by fair means or foul. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 5th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji, Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation, the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The European settlers who came to this soil centuries ago received the vast benefits of the land and waters at the expense of the indigenous peoples who lived here first and secured their access through faulty promises, broken treaties, and even outright theft. Their descendants today need to recognize this past, that begin reparations and build relationships to restore equality and respect for the future. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Electoral politics is, in fact, a strategy applied by the ruling oligarchy through the permanent state apparatus to manage the population. However, it is not something mysterious, secret, or transcendental. The term has arisen to poorly substitute for a term and concept still prohibited in serious political action, namely class power. Perhaps the last American to seriously describe this phenomenon, both empirically and theoretically, was the renegade sociologist C. Wright Mills. Mills called it the, quote, power elite, unquote. That comes from the article, Who Must Go? Permanent Government Versus the People, quote, Electoral Politics, unquote, and, quote, The Deep State, unquote, by Dr. T.P. Wilkinson, posted April 3rd. If the government, be it the president, Congress, the courts, or any federal, state, or local agent or agency, can decide that any person has no rights, then that person becomes less than a citizen, less than human, less than deserving of respect, dignity, civility, and bodily integrity. He or she becomes an quote-unquote it, a faceless number that can be tallied and tracked, a quantifiable mass of cells that can be discarded without conscience, an expendable cost that can be written off without a second thought, or an animal that can be bought, sold, branded, chained, caged, bred, neutered, and euthanized at will. It's a slippery slope that justifies all manner of violations in the name of national security, the interests of the state, and the so-called greater good. Yet those who founded this country believed that what we conceive of as our rights were given to us by God. We are created equal, according to the nation's founding document, the Declaration of Independence, and that government cannot create, nor can it extinguish, our God-given rights. To do so would be to anoint the government with godlike powers and elevate it above the citizenry. That comes from the article, "The Government Wants to Play God. What Does That Mean for Our Freedoms?" by John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted April 3rd, originally published on the Rutherford Institute. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or IRGC, identified two of the deceased as Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, along with his deputy, General Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi, being among the seven people killed in the IDF attack. Washington and Wall Street are the largest backers of the settler colonial regime, which has occupied Palestine for more than three quarters of a century, despite the facade of disagreements between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden. Weapons are continuing to flow into Israel for the genocidal war against the Palestinian people in Gaza and throughout the entire occupied territories. Iran demanded a hearing before the United Nations Security Council on April 2nd, where Deputy Ambassador Zahra Ershadi spoke for the government in Tehran. The leadership inside Iran have vowed to retaliate for the Israeli bombing of its embassy in Syria. That comes from the article, "Iran Condemns Israeli Attack on Embassy in Syria, UN Security Council Hearing," statement by Deputy Ambassador Zahra Ershadi, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted April 3rd. Recently, France, the country that currently leads anti-Russian efforts and is even considering direct intervention in Ukraine, announced that it will provide the neo-Nazi regime with a new military package. The equipment of the aid includes surface-to-air missiles and hundreds of armored vehicles. However, these are not new weapons in perfect working condition. These are very old equipment, taken from the Ministry of Defense's warehouses, some of which are over 40 years old. Despite the questionable quality of the weapons, Defense Minister Sébastien Lecornu praised the importance of French aid and stated that Kiev needs this type of equipment to fight a protracted war. That comes from the article, "France Sending Obsolete Weapons to Ukraine," by Lucas Leroz de Almeida, posted April 3rd, originally published on InfoBricks.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
We start the program by considering Canada's role in NATO. On this question, we talked to Eve Engler, the activist, author, and Canadian foreign policy critic, I asked him why forming a defensive military alliance was any worse than joining it in the field, as in World War II.
Well, concretely, if you go back to the founding of NATO, NATO led Canada into sending troops to Europe to help block indigenous communism and socialism. So to basically blunt the left in Western Europe, which was very strong at the end of World War II. Communists would have won in Italy the first election if the Americans hadn't intervened. They had 30% of the vote in France and a bunch of the ministers and the government, kind of similar dynamic in Greece. And so what NATO was initially conceived as was as a tool to blunt the left. It was a perception that communism was the way of the future. And Lester Pearson, who was then Canada's foreign minister around the creation of NATO, he was open about this, even in the House of Commons. I've quoted this speech many times where he actually he said that the communists were taking over all elements of society, including the kindergartens. And we needed NATO to blunt that. So that was an element, and we stationed thousands of troops in Western Europe, and obviously many tens of thousands of U.S. troops were stationed in Western Europe, partly as part of that process. The other part of the process was it was about bringing the decolonizing world. The colonial powers were weakened during World War II, and the U.S. was in ascendance, and it was about bringing the geopolitical order under a U.S.-led umbrella, and to sort of have a, let's call it a fake decolonization, where the decolonization, to the extent it happened, would you know, be with U.S. dominant. But concretely, we began providing all kinds of weapons to the colonial powers in the 1950s as they were suppressing independence movements in you know, the Kikuyu in Kenya, in Congo, obviously the French in Algeria. That was the most egregious example, when there was 400,000 French troops in Algeria. Canada was giving and not selling, giving bullets and the like to the French, knowing full well where the French were using those weapons. So that formal alliance that Canada was three countries, Canada, US, and Britain were the three countries that initiated the initial secret talks to form NATO. Some people say NATO was a Canadian idea. That basically brought Canada into a deepening alliance around colonialism, around protecting the elite structure within Western Europe. And that's the history of it. And then you know, fast forward into today, and NATO is a tool that has been used to justify Canada bombing Yugoslavia in the late 1990s, bombing Libya in 2011, stationing troops on Russia's border. It's used to justify expanding military spending. It's not the only tool or alliance, but it's a central one in justifying a more militaristic, Washington-centered Canadian foreign policy.
Does this membership in NATO then curtail Canadian sovereignty in any way?
I mean, it doesn't formally, but it does. I would see it more as a tool in the hands of the pro-imperialist, pro-militarist elements of Canadian society. And it regularly gets brought up as that, you know, we're part of this alliance. We have to support the alliance. We have to send troops to Russia's border. We're part of the alliance. The alliance is getting ready to bomb Libya. We have to participate. That's kind of how it's used. Most instances, because, you know, they frame it as a defensive alliance, and it's not, of course. They and you know, if there is a NATO member that's attacked, we are technically responsible to defend that member. Now, you don't, how you defend that member is up for discussion. Do you send one troop? Do you send 10,000 troops? That's a right. There's all kinds of ways in which you can parse that out. But in the practical world, where NATO is not a defensive alliance, where it's a belligerent alliance in the real world, the contributions, you know, Canada didn't need to lead the bombing of Libya in 2011. Some NATO members didn't participate in the bombing of and the war, not just bombing. We had special forces and naval vessels that were part of that war. They didn't even participate. So it doesn't, you know, in a sense, I wouldn't emphasize this idea that it impinges on Canadian sovereignty. In fact, I would say that NORAD, in many ways, is a more clear-cut impingement on sovereignty than NATO is. But in practical reality, NATO becomes, I would say, it undercuts the popular ethos that is somewhat ambivalent towards military spending and ambivalent towards joining U.S.-led wars, which I think the Canadian public is somewhat ambivalent towards both of those things. And NATO basically strengthens the hands of those who you know, want more participation. So to call it undermining sovereignty, I don't know if I would use that language exactly, but certainly it undercuts ambiguousness or ambivalenceness towards militarism and U.S. imperialism.
Hmm. You mentioned earlier that this NATO was basically put down the left as it started to emerge following 1945. But the NDP, has it been consistently supportive of this NATO? How do you, you know, because that's a party of the left in Canada. So how do you kind of string those two things together?
The CCF was before, immediately the CCF leadership backed NATO. Now that CCF's the predecessor to the NDP. And it took a pro-NATO position. It actually subverted internal democracy. There was a convention coming up in 1950, and the leadership came out in favor before allowing members to have that discussion. And for years, more than a decade, two decades almost, NATO was the most contentious issue at CCF and then later NDP conventions. And where the sort of activist base, peace-minded base of the party, increasingly pushed the Canada to NATO position. And then they finally won that in 66, I believe it was, a convention. The party had a Canada out of NATO position for about 20 years. And then when Ed Broadbent in 1987 looked like he had a real shot at becoming prime minister, the media started really kind of raising this Canada to NATO policy of the NDP and sort of made like an issue of the matter. And the Broadbent basically, without any ever passing it at a convention, just kind of like was able to toss out this policy and rewrote the policy to say that basically the party didn't have a Canada NATO position. It was never formally withdrawn, and you know, there was never a vote. So you know, the NDP voted for the bombing of Libya. 2011, same thing with Yugoslavia. Even Sven Robinson, who's certainly the most left-wing foreign affairs critic in NDP history, he even went on, he supported the bombing of Yugoslavia for the first part. He changes course, I think like 40 or 50 days into the bombing campaign, but he he initially endorses it. So the NDP has been pro-NATO. Now, the big factions of the sort of social democratic world within Western Europe have also been pro-NATO. And so it was sort of anti-communist, in the sense of the French Communist Party or the Italian Communist Party in the 1940s and 50s. But I don't think that that's, there's no necessary contradiction between the NDP-CCF being supportive of NATO and NATO having this element of it as history. It's no longer important to the alliance today, but an element of its history of having been a tool of weakening the Western European left, or more specifically, the Western European communist movement.
Okay, let's suppose you're the prime minister for a second, and you have the opportunity to take out of NATO, but you got to consider that a lot of the people who might support that want NATO completely gone. Not just we're out of it, because if we're out of it, then NATO is still going to carry on doing what they're doing, except that how much influence will we have as an independent nation, at least in NATO, within NATO? We could sit at the table and say, well, okay, let's break up NATO, but in the meantime, I'm going to stay there. What I'm saying is having an influence at the table, is that, basically even to the, you even might be able to moderate or eliminate the use of nuclear weapons within the house, so to speak. So how do you respond to that?
Well, it would be the other way around. In fact, the nuclear weapons question is a good one on that front, because the reason why the Canadian government has been so opposed to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which I forget the exact number now, but I think it's 130 countries have signed, or having more than 130 countries endorsed it, and it came into operation after 50 countries formally endorsed it, and that was about 2 years ago. I'm not sure what the number's up to now. It's probably, I think it's 60 or 60 something. And it's an effort to abolish nuclear weapons, and it General Assembly votes. It's more than 2/3 of countries in the world support these votes. And the Canadian government, which we of course don't have nuclear weapons. And I think that, even Canada outside of NATO may still not take up the nuclear question like I would like to see it, but the major obstacle, and the Canadian officials are even state this, that we can't endorse the bid to abolish nuclear weapons because we are part of an alliance where nuclear weapons are part of the military strategy. NATO has a working group on nuclear weapons that incorporates the use of nuclear weapons as part of their military strategy. So if the Canadian government withdrew from NATO, its margin for maneuver on taking clear anti-nuclear policies, which they claim to support, right? The Trudeau government claims to support abolishing nuclear weapons, but yet they won't actually sign on to an international treaty that's trying to do that. So NATO becomes an obstacle to that kind of thing. Now, the more general question, who we send to the NATO, it's Canadian generals and Canadian military figures, right? These are not peace activists who are going and making the case for demilitarization. These are military officials, and some of them are global affairs diplomats, but it's a large part it's military officials, and it's a body for them to organize themselves collectively internationally. It's a body for them to basically ramp themselves up, really, in terms of taking ever more militaristic positions. So no, I don't think that there's any sort of sensible position that's like, let's continue to have a seat at the table to make the case against militarism. The case, if Canada was to withdraw from NATO, that would have massive reverberations on the alliance. I think if in a short-term perspective, if Canada tried to do that, you had some sort of left-wing government that tried to do that, the Americans would try to overthrow the Canadian government. I mean, it would the implications would be so significant that now, if it was done as part of a process of building and rebuilding anti-war forces, that would not just be within Canada, that would be within all the NATO countries. For the most part, those anti-war movements have been fairly weak. I mean, the recent response to the destruction of Gaza has rekindled some anti-war organizing and mobilization. But if you go back 6 months, we were in a very weak point. So if we rebuild this anti-NATO position, I know there's a big NATO summit in Washington, D.C. in July, and there's big protests planned in the U.S. Against that. Rebuild, put on the political agenda of Canada, Britain, Germany, France, Poland, wherever that out of NATO kind of position. If Canada, let's say 10 years down the road, 5 years down the road, there's the movement is building and Canada withdraws, and that can help spur the forces within Poland and Germany and France calling for withdrawal. That to me is the kind of realistic scenario which Canada out of with NATO would play out, and it could have quite a beneficial effect on unraveling the whole alliance, even though of course it only just be one country withdrawing.
Before you go, is there anything you want to say to tell listeners about your recent book, co-written with Owen Schalk, called Canada's Fight Against Democracy?
No, it's just it's a details 20 plus coups that Canada's been involved with. Half of those are sort of passively supportive, like against Mossadegh in Iran or Arbenz in Guatemala. And then other examples are more active. The most clear-cut example, of course, is against the Aristide and the Haitian government in 2004, but also against Allende in Chile and Lumumba and Kwame Nkrumah and the like. And it's a book that I think, it's some history that is important history, but it also tells us a lot about this whole business about foreign interference, that there's a huge storm about foreign interference, and we don't really talk about Canada's interference abroad. And that the book, I think, makes question some of this whole concern about foreign interference. And then it also it I think helps to understand whether we were in conflict with China and Russia and Iran, and they say it's because those are authoritarian countries and we believe in democracy. And you say, well, we've been involved in trying to overthrow 20 different governments. Are we really concerned about democracy? So it makes you, I think, helps understand that these conflicts with China and Russia and Iran maybe are about something else besides just the question of democracy versus authoritarianism. So I think the book, helps people make sense of some of the current foreign policy, but it's also, I think, just an important history. I just did a few events in Southern Ontario. There's a couple upcoming events in Kingston and Saskatoon, and then I'm going to be doing events out in Vancouver Island, and then throughout the prairies in early and mid June. So anyone listening, you can check out my website for upcoming information on the events.
Okay. Always a pleasure having you on. Thank you very much for appearing on the show, Yves.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with author, activist, and Canadian foreign policy critic, Yves Engler.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
NATO is the first attempt in history to establish an aggressive global military formation, one which includes members of or partners in a third of the nations on the planet on five continents, and NATO seeks to expand active operations to new territories. If there's one person Global Research NewsHour has contacted over the last 11 years who is a solid grounding in everything objectionable about NATO, it is Rick Rozoff. Rick Rozoff is an investigative journalist who lives and works in Chicago, an active opponent of war, militarism, and intervention for over 40 years. He has written on the threat of international militarization, especially in the form of the globalization of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. Rick Rozoff, thanks again for joining us.
No, thank you for having me, Michael. I always appreciate the opportunity of speaking with you.
It's been said that the real reason an atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was not really to end the war. The Allied Soviet Union had said they were preparing an invasion in early August 1945, so the U.S. figured it would drop the bombs first and thereby send the message that they had won the war by forcing Japan's surrender. But they were also warning the Soviet Union about their awesome arsenal that could be targeting them. I bring this up because I suspect the role of NATO to defend the world from the Soviet threat may not be accurate either. There's another story behind building up NATO. What, in your view, is the real reason NATO came into existence?
It was a shift in World War II, where the Western powers, U.S., Britain, French resistance, and Free French, and such like, continued the war, but shifted from waging war against the Axis powers, Germany, Italy, Romania, and so forth, towards the Soviet Union. I mean, that's quite simply that. And Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was the top commander of Allied forces in Europe during World War II, became the first supreme Allied commander of NATO when NATO was set up in 1949. So it was a very smooth transition down to the very same, top commander. World War II did not, in that sense, end so much as it was reconfigured and directed eastward. That's my read on it. And of course, it was 75 years ago next month that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was established, initially with 12 members, all 12 of which, with the exception of Italy, could lay claim to being on the North Atlantic Ocean, by the way. Italy, you really wanted to stretch the point also, through being in the Mediterranean, which is an inlet of the Atlantic Ocean. Of course, now you're looking, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but you're looking at NATO, which has grown appreciably, where the majority of its members are nowhere near the North Atlantic Ocean.
So basically you're saying that, the alliance, to fight off Hitler, I mean, they guess they felt they had a good thing coming. So, but I guess there's that solidarity or whatever, let's just hold on to this and just direct it towards the big red bear. Is that essentially what you're saying?
That's exactly what happened. And they pivoted, to use a popular expression, on a dime. It didn't take very long. Almost immediately after VE Day, and certainly after VJ Day, victory in Europe, victory over Japan, that you alluded to, then the Soviet Union became the replacement for the Third Reich and Mussolini. And so the military apparatus that the United States had established during the years from 1943 to 45 in Italy and in Germany and in France and in the Low Countries, Benelux countries, then became the foundation for NATO, which remained and remains to this day, by the way, where the supreme Allied commander of NATO has always been an American general or admiral. So that much has not changed from 1949, or for that matter, from 1945 until the current day.
So during the Cold War, I mean, was there anything, about NATO? Because, I mean, you started criticizing NATO before the fall of the Berlin Wall, as I understand it. So what were you finding objectionable back in the Cold War era that set you off?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to put too fine a point on this because I think, you know, it's going to distract from talking about post-Cold War NATO. And there are people out there who may want to defend NATO up until 1989 or up until 1991. And my argument is really not with them so much anymore because as interesting as that is, I think we have more pressing concerns, to be honest, Michael. And I personally feel that it was meant as a display of American military might in Europe, not only against the Soviet Union and its allies in Eastern Europe, but also against political parties in countries like France, Belgium, Italy, Communist Party in the first instance, that may have wanted to reach some rapprochement with the Soviet Union, and the permanent deployment of U.S. and U.S. You know, Sixth Fleet is still based in Italy, and U.S. still has nuclear weapons in five European countries and such like. But this is all the result of using NATO to position the U.S. military for a permanent presence in Europe, first of all against Soviet Union, then against the Soviet successor state, Russia. It also, you know, you mentioned nuclear weapons. I believe it was as early as 1951, which is to say only 2 years after the founding of NATO, that the U.S. moved nuclear weapons into Europe, into Britain, initially under NATO auspices, and why NATO continues to maintain tactical nuclear weapons in Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, Germany, and Turkey under what NATO calls burden sharing or nuclear sharing arrangements.
Well, NATO underwent a transformation after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism because it otherwise would no longer have a reason to continue. But it did. What do you know about what the thinkers at the top were thinking? I mean, how and when did they come to the conclusion that NATO would now be an aggressive force behind human rights? I mean, subsequently attacking people in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Libya.
The 1989 speech by President H.W. Bush in Mainz, Germany, whence the expression, it's actually sometimes published with the expression I'm going to mention in a second as its title, A Europe Whole and Free. Sometimes a Europe Whole, Free, and at Peace. And this is after the the dismantling of the wall in Berlin and the beginning of the reunification of Germany. So at that point, it's clear coming from Washington, coming from the White House, that Europe was to be united, the exact word, there was to be a continental system, you know, if I'm not going too far astray, comparable to those of Napoleon Bonaparte, or for that matter, Hitler, that would unite the entire European continent under one military command. That has been NATO's objective since 1989, certainly since 1991, with the formal dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, which itself, by the way, was founded 6 years after NATO and in reaction to not only NATO being founded, but Germany, West Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany, being brought into NATO the preceding year, contrary to the Potsdam, you know, accords reached by Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union at the end of World War II. So what NATO has accomplished in the interim and is now going to celebrate in all its splendor in July in the United States and Washington at its 75th anniversary summit is that indeed the entire European continent, with the exception of Russia and Belarus, have now been brought under NATO command.
But NATO is not just a military force. It seems to me it's a parasite. There are components of NATO that involve industry and jobs, and a whole economic and financial infrastructure has grown around NATO. So there would be massive losses of jobs and a shrinking of the tax base, meaning, you know, social programs as well would be compromised. Can you address these sorts of concerns about some who would resist ending NATO or getting out of NATO?
I mean, you're correct about the fact that the NATO country, I mean, let's look at some arithmetic. The annual collective military spending, this is official, right, through defense ministries and the Defense Department of the United States. It excludes, you know, a good deal of other military-related spending. But the official numbers, with the U.S. leading the way by a long shot to the tune of something like 68%, but nevertheless, NATO countries account for $1.3 trillion in military spending per annum. This is as compared to, for example, Russia, maybe $60 billion. you know, a small fraction of that. The population, combined or collective population, NATO countries, now with Sweden joining, is 1 billion. You know, Russia is 150 million, 150 million. So to place these matters in perspective. The other thing that needs to be mentioned, and this is the NATO summit in Washington in the summer, will be the second time a NATO summit has been held in the capital of the United States. That symbolism is not to be missed. There was only one other summit in the United States that was here in Chicago in 2012. But the first summit in Washington, the first in the United States, was in 1999 to mark the 50th anniversary of the creation of NATO. This one will mark the 75th anniversary. 50 years ago, I'm sorry, not 50 years ago, but 25 years ago in 1999, when NATO met in Washington, NATO had 16 members. When it finishes its summit this July in Washington, it will have 32 members, which is, say, twice as many as it had in 1999 when it launched its first full-fledged war against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. In the interim also, starting in the 90s, you read an excerpt, which I assume was mine. It sounded very much like mine at the beginning of the program. NATO has, in addition to those 32 full members, partners in the neighborhood of probably 40 officially. And if you want to include the fact that NATO considers the African Union to be a collective partner, it has a liaison office next to that of the African Union in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. But officially, they have 40 members who, together with the, not 40 members, 40 partners who, together with the 32 members, 72 countries, are on all six inhabited continents, bar none. And as there are military personnel in Antarctica from NATO countries, you could throw that one in for good measure. And all the continents in the world have NATO presence. That's something of so historically unprecedented scale and scope and ambition and nature that it really puzzles me. And I have to admit, it makes me despondent sometime that for 25 years, I've been trying to alert people to this, to the scale of it. And I feel that people are either indifferent to it, they downplay it, they mock it. Global research is not immune itself from running articles that suggest that, you know, NATO is a paper tiger, paper pussycat, in one person's parlance, and so forth. But I'll stake my claim, and hope I'm not wrong, that the NATO is a deadly serious business and a real threat to world peace. And if it is, and it has been for the past 25 years, and I think the peace movement and other forces in the world have been grossly negligent in taking this one on.
Well, going forward, then, what would you assume NATO's next targets would be if there's no resistance? And, you know, how do you expect their development to evolve over the next 2 or 3 years?
You know, they're very open about these matters. There's nothing esoteric about them. Go to the NATO website. They have two features today. One is that the Moldova is solidifying its relationship with NATO. It's going to join. But, you know, as a precondition for joining, it cannot have foreign troops on its territory, nor can it have unresolved territorial disputes. And Transnistria, you know, checks both those boxes off. So it would be necessary, and Transnistria is surrounded by Moldova in the west, Ukraine on the east, it would be necessary to expel the Russian peacekeeping force of a couple thousand troops and then reincorporate Transnistria into Moldova in order for it to join NATO. But, you know, that movement is well underway. The General Secretary of NATO, as you may know, has just recently made a trip to the three South Caucasus nations of Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. Armenia has suspended its membership in the Collective Security Treaty Organization. I would argue, justifiably, you know, given Russia's unwillingness to defend it against attacks from Azerbaijan. And so what are they doing? They're wrapping up. They're doing a mopping up operation. They are absorbing what's left of the former Soviet Union, except for, at least the moment, Belarus and Russia itself. They've already incorporated, of course, some 15 years ago, they incorporated, or more than that, 17 years ago, they 20 years ago, they incorporated three former Soviet Union republics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, they're, ensconced themselves deeply in the three countries I've just mentioned in the South Caucasus. Ukraine, I don't have to tell you about, and Moldova, that's the former Soviet Union. So they have not only, there was a statement by George W. Bush during the round of massive NATO expansion in the early part of the century, where at one NATO summit, seven countries joined at one time. Again, that's totally unprecedented. Two of those former Yugoslav federal republics and three of them former Soviet republics. There was a statement attributed to George W. Bush saying the Warsaw Pact has now become NATO, in fact.
Rick Rozov, thank you very much for your intelligent and eloquent analysis.
Yeah, I wish I had better news to bring you, my friend. But, if we sit back and we allow a military monolith of this scale to spread over the last 33 years, and we effectively do nothing about it, then, they're not going to be held in check unless we hold them in check. And we have to sound the alarm that the existence of a military bloc of 70-some-odd countries on all continents is something that really should ring some bells and really should raise some alarms, and people should really commit themselves to looking into it and doing what they can to rein this thing in until it can be dismantled.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Thank you.
We've been speaking to Rick Rozov. He's a journalist and a longtime activist against NATO. He joined us from Chicago. Well, April 4th is the anniversary of the founding of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, but it is also the anniversary of Martin Luther King speaking out against the war in Vietnam, thus extending his mission to speaking out against what he called the triplets of racism, materialism, and extreme militarism, which has become the hallmarks of what's embodied by the Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamil Baraka is the national organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace and an editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report. He joins us now to discuss in more detail the Black radical perspective on NATO. It's been about a year since I last had a conversation with you, Ajamil, but it's good to have you back. Thanks.
Well, Michael, it's good to be back. Thank you so much.
The Black radical perspective sees Black people in the U.S. from a different lens. You see the darker side, transatlantic slavery, indigenous land theft, and genocidal policy that children in the classroom did not see. So describe through that particular lens how you view or came to view NATO, conceived after World War II, acting supposedly in our collective self-defense.
Well, Michael, it's interesting because we, we have a different experience in terms of our connection, our relationship to this whole Western project, with NATO being a part of it. That for those of us who have experienced the Western project, that is the receiving end of the Western project, this civilizational project that started in 1492 when Europeans spilled out of Europe into the Americas, where the material base was laid for what emerged as Western Europe and its predominance for the next 500 years on the backs of conquered, stolen indigenous land and African labor. So because of that experience, for those of us who were able to emerge with our consciousness intact, there was never any illusions about the nature of this project. So therefore, we are much more critical when it comes to structures and institutions like a North Atlantic Treaty Organization. For us, we see this as a continuation of the attempts on the part of the U.S. and the West to maintain its hegemony. This instrument we see as part of what we refer to as the US, EU, NATO axis of domination. And so our experience is much different than how, as you said, people are exposed to the justification, the rationale for NATO that one is exposed to in your typical international relations class on college campuses across the U.S. We see NATO as an instrument of domination. And we isn't that just an emotional response from our part, but our experience directly with NATO has been one of domination, brutality. We remember that it was through NATO that the Portuguese colonialists were being trained to fight against the African Liberation Forces in Mozambique, in Angola, and in Guinea-Bissau, okay? So we've always seen NATO as a weapon that was used, not just in terms of its rationale being a bulwark of defense against the Soviet Union or whatever, but we've seen this as a instrument that's been used globally by Western powers to again maintain and to advance global white supremacy.
And since 1948, it seems to have gone from a defensive alliance to a more aggressive alliance back in as far back as 1999. Did your group then see it as having gone from bad to worse, or is it basically the same kind of manifestation of, you know, white supremacy?
It's gone from bad to worse, primarily because with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, there was no countervailing power, so that allowed for the U.S. to use this instrument in a more creative and brutal way. There's not a coincidence that you have the elimination of this countervailing power from the Soviet Union, and we have this massive attack on Serbia in 1999. So this is a reflection of the kind of weapon that NATO has become, and that's what makes it even more dangerous than it was in the past. Is again, we are reminded as African people of what happened in Libya, even under so-called black president, that NATO was used as a weapon to go in and to destroy the most prosperous African state on the continent. And we see that this expansion of NATO eastward toward the Russian Federation has resulted in this horrific conflict, this proxy war in Ukraine. So the lawlessness of the West has been such that this NATO weapon's been used in a way that has only resulted in death and destruction every place we've seen NATO raise its head.
Yeah, well, just picking up on an earlier point, I mean, NATO has its various outcroppings. I mean, CENTCOM in the Middle East and SOUTHCOM in South America and AFRICOM in Africa. Maybe you could talk about what you've seen about the way these various regional groups that run against the welfare of areas in question and are not supporting their mutual security.
Well, you know, Michael, this is the reality that we have to deal with. The fact of the matter is, beyond NATO as a instrument of the U.S. and Western European powers, you have, as you just referenced, the U.S. global command structures, where the U.S. Divided the entire planet into these command structures. And with the objective, again, to maintain global hegemony. So you have over 800 bases across the planet in more than 80 nations. And so together, the NATO structures, the U.S. command structures, they are equal to hegemony. And this is why we talk about the U.S., EU, NATO axis of domination. So we are glad, though, Michael, that more and more people are beginning to understand the true nature of this NATO project. And there's more opposition to it as a consequence of the of this conflict that emerged, Biden's war in Ukraine, and now as a consequence of the genocide we've seen in Gaza, there's more a rejection now of the legitimacy of these structures. People are looking at these things much more differently now, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, we've heard about the impact of NATO against foreign targets, but how does it impact the people, you know, in the United States and in the base companies, countries themselves, which are themselves colonial within? How do the, you know, carrying out those attacks, you know, affect the people living at home?
Well, you know, these I mean, NATO itself, of course, is a not only is it an instrument to advance U.S. and Western imperialist objectives, but is also a instrument that's been used to continue to enrich the pocketbooks of the U.S., primarily U.S.-based defense industry. And because of that, because of the necessity to legitimize war and conflict, it has helped to create an acceptance of war and conflict among sectors of the population up until now, to justify NATO's existence. And that has been a problematic for the populations, because resources that should be otherwise used to address the objective human rights and needs of the people for housing and health care and education, clean water, are transferred instead into the military industrial complex. So the only ones that really benefit from this environment of militarism and brutality and war is in fact the ruling class elements in the US, in Western Europe. For the vast majority of the people, of the vast majority of the working class, this has been a disaster. And so it's always had that negative impact when it comes to whenever the political elites are committed to war, because not only are they making money, but the soldiers that make up the armies that fight and die are primarily the working classes. So it's a very detrimental and backward position that the working class finds itself in vis-a-vis the militarism coming from its ruling elements.
Ajamu, I've got to break it there, but thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Ajamu Baraka is the national organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace and an editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.